yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court is pleased to welcome students from the Trinity School in Midland to our proceedings this morning. We have three causes on our oral submission docket. In the order in which they'll be presented, they are as follows. State Farm Fire and Casualty Company versus Joseph C. Reed and others from Brazoria County. Tarrant County Water Control and Improvement District Number 1 versus Hoff Incorporated and others from Navarro County. And Lawrence P. DeRoss and Karen DeRoss individually and his next friends of Leslie M. Miller versus Jack Freeman and Ruth Horn from Bexar County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these causes and will complete the submission docket before lunch. Justice Enoch is recused in the first cause, but will sit in the second and third causes. Court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in State Farm versus Reed.
May it please the court, Ms. Kathleen Byrne will present argument for petitioner. She reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Your Honor, as you know, my name is Kathleen Byrne. I represent, it's my honor to represent State Farm Fire and Casualty petitioner in our efforts to rectify what we believe is a seriously flawed decision by the Court of Appeals. We appreciate the court's generous accommodation of a physical deformity, but more important, Your Honor, State Farm appreciates the courts having recognized the importance of the issues presented in this case to the jurisprudence of the state. The implications of this case fall far beyond the actual controversy and will affect every homeowner in the state of Texas because of the risk contemplated, the underlying basis of understanding of the risk contemplated by that insuring agreement for the owners of business premises who happen to have not only the 14,000 owners of residential daycare premises in Texas, but in addition, every homeowner in the state of Texas. The handouts that you have been presented with correspond to our exhibit boards 1, 2, 3, and 4. They are exactly in the order of the handout which you have been presented. And our efforts will be to concentrate on the implications of these major documents to this controversy and how they interrelate one another. For purposes of convenience and for future reference, should I not be able to address everything that I would like to this morning, the areas that have been highlighted in pink are the areas of the particular areas with which State Farm has dispute based on the underlying determinations, both by the trial court in handout 2 and the Court of Appeals in handout number 4. As a preliminary matter, it is imperative to place this controversy within the context of a homeowner's policy. The premises insured is a resident. The issues before the court have become narrowed based on State Farm's having conceded the applicability of attorney's fees no longer in dispute. And there are, in addition, significant implications of the respondents having conceded that the activity on the premises was, in fact, a business pursuit. On the premises in question, we are undertaking residential daycare. The premises had a pool. In applying for licensing as a residential licensed facility, Mrs. Reed identified, in response to a question about bodies of water, that yes, there was a pool on the premises. She also disclosed in questioning, and this is Exhibit 11 to State Farm's application, in response to the question, what measures will be undertaken to prevent access to the body of water that you have identified as being on the premises? The response to that was a 6-foot chain link fence separates the play area from the pool. This fence did not end up separating this area from the pool because this young child gained access to the play area and drowned in the pool. Therefore, the fundamental undertaking to prevent access failed. As recited in the underlying judgment, the Reeves, both Reeves, not just Mrs. Reeves, were negligent in the maintenance of the premises where the accident made the basis of this dispute occur, and that they were failed to maintain the premises to prevent children from gaining access. Gaining access, prevention of gaining access to the pool was the condition of licensing. It is recited in the liability determination and the underlying case, and is undisputed under the facts that this was not met. This was negligence. There are implications from this, Your Honors. We also have to proceed in consideration not only of the facts, but of the procedural context of this case. It is important to realize that the plaintiffs who were formerly adverse parties in the underlying case became realigned in the coverage determination and against State Farm pursuant to their covenant not to execute and State Farm's reservation of rights to deny coverage. There are implications that flow from both parties having proceeded on cross motions to summary judgment. Cross motions to summary judgment implies that there are no disputed facts and there are only issues of law that are placed before the court. Therefore, as a preliminary matter, we need to note the respondent's request for a remand to determine anything further is completely waived by the very nature of having proceeded to the court on cross motions on issues of law only. And those issues are whether this policy, pertinent provisions of the policy are over here, provides coverage, creates a duty to indemnify based on this underlying determination, the liability determination in the underlying case. There are several important aspects of this policy, but we would like to focus chiefly on the business pursuits exclusion and the exception to that exclusion within the context of daycare. However, the reason that we are focusing on this is because that is the area that is in dispute based on the underlying determination. We are not, absolutely not, omitting the reference to the policy within the context of all of its terms. This court's opinions have made it abundantly clear that no terms of the policy are to be rendered meaningless. These include the basic undertaking of a homeowner's policy. In our exhibits attached to our applications, there is the Fraser article that lists the consideration that homeowner's policies are not supposed to insure business risk. In accordance with this, there is a declaration on the face of our policy that there are no business pursuits conducted on the premises. None. Why? The declaration, as Professor Tinker teaches us, that's attachment number 22 to our application, tells us that the declaration of a policy, none of which any of the underlying courts paid any attention to, the declaration forms the absolute basis of the insuring, of the undertaking, the risk undertaken by the carrier in exchange for the premium tendered by the insured. Then there is, in addition, after the nature of the policy, after the declaration, and after the liability section, we have two important matters that need to be focused on in the liability section of the policy. The first is that the insurer, the insurance company, agrees to pay the sums that it shall become legally obligated to pay. Legally obligated to pay. If there is no legal obligation to pay at the threshold, there is no insuring agreement. This is the error of the underlying court. They went straight to the exception without examining everything in context. The second underlying premise of the insuring agreement is that the damages that the insured is legally obligated to pay must come within the terms of the policy. Now, finally, we get to the exclusion. Now, there has been, as the attachments to State Farm's application demonstrate, there has been significant controversy in the cases over the substantive effect to accord this business pursuits exception, business pursuits exclusion and the exception to that exclusion. But as the Maryland Law Review article that's also attached to the and provided to the court with our application notes, the problem with interpretations has been, on the one hand, courts say anything that's in connection with daycare has got to be failure to supervise. State Farm advanced that opinion in the lower courts, not as the primary focus, but as saying that you can't obviate the liability, which is based on failure to supervise. That's one polar view of this exception. It gives the problem with that view, it never allows any application of the exception to the exclusion. On the one pole, you have failure to supervise. Anything that happens on daycare is going to be failure to supervise. On the other hand, you have anything that's going to happen in daycare is going to necessarily be in connection with taking care of children, which is going to be giving effect solely to the exception. That's wrong, and that's not reasonable. The reason is that you have to give effect to all of the terms. There is a way to find a way through all of this, a way to give effect to all of the terms of the policy and still take into consideration the determination in the underlying case and all of the terms of the policy. We would like to respond at this point to the three points, the three interpretations of the policy on which the respondents claim, they basically claim that the policy is ambiguous and that they have three reasonable interpretations of the policy. The first is that the policy business pursuits exclusion does not address premises defects. The second is that it does not address the culpability of Mr. Reed, who they claim had no connection with the business. Also, it doesn't address activities that fit the exception but don't fit the exclusion. There's something wrong with all of these because neither of them is reasonable, taking into consideration all of the policy and the liability determination.
Counsel, you need then to prevail, do you not, in explaining all three of those, because under the law of Texas, if there is an ambiguity, it is construed against State Farm.
That's absolutely, Justice Doggett, and that is the recent case is Hudson Energy versus National Union Fire. But a basic premise of that is that each of the interpretations have to be reasonable.
You're not asking us to change Hudson Energy or Valderrama or any of the many cases in Texas that say you construe ambiguities against the insurer. You're just asking us to look at this case and determine that there's not any reasonable basis
right.
for ambiguity.
That all of the interpretations...
All three wrong.
That they are all wrong. What's wrong with there is something very fundamentally wrong with the determination that business pursuits does not encompass premises defects. There's three things wrong with that argument. Why? Because the respondents have conceded that there was a business pursuit, that the activity in question was a business pursuit. Now, why is that significant? In the opinion, in the top left-hand side, on page 663, the Court of Appeals states, the respondents here argue, on the other hand, that the premises defect, the hole in the fence that the poor child crawled under was what caused the injury, not the lack of supervision. Therefore, the exclusion does not apply. We agree with State Farm's interpretation of the first part of the exclusion. The child's injury occurred as a result of business pursuits. What does that mean? Any business pursuits, when you look at the terms of the policy, any business pursuits are excluded. That necessarily means that business pursuits, that premises defects are encompassed in that, because a premise defect arguably could have a connection with the business pursuit. Now, respondents have not challenged that determination in the Court of Appeals by motion for rehearing, and they haven't brought any cross point here. Their point on the contention that the business pursuits exclusion doesn't encompass premises defects is flawed, because the Court of Appeals basically disagreed with them on this, and they haven't challenged it. It's also flawed for the reason that this court has noted in the Keach opinion. Now, I know that they're going to say that that's a jury charge case and it's distinguishable. Naturally, it is. But the court made a very important recognition of a legal principle there, that any condition on the premises is necessarily would have been created at some point in time by someone's activity or failure to act, which under the law are the same. The other two contentions that they claim are reasonable do not fly either, because the contention concerning Mr. Reed is completely gone by the pleadings in this case and the underlying determination, which has been noted affected both Mr. Reed and Mrs. Reed. And in record excerpts to our application 1, 6, 7, and 8, all of the allegations pertain to the Reeds. Both Reeds agreed to care for and agreed to care for the child. Now, the other activities that they have identified are errands, running errands. Your Honors, this child did not die because errands were being run. This child did not die based on the underlying determination because Mr. Reed was taking a nap. And incidentally, that moots the contention about Mr. Reed anyway, because of the concession of his activity. He also did not die because of a household offense under the underlying determination. As I've noted, we'd like to reserve our time for rebuttal.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Thank you. My name is Otto Hewitt. I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, the Reeds and Fords. Before we get into this sort of esoteric discussion about ambiguity and business pursuits, I think it's important to remind the court that this case at its heart involves tragic death of an 18-month-old child and two good, solid, hardworking, tax-paying Texas families, the Reeds and the Fords. It also involves an insurance company that, in our view, would rather litigate than honor its own policies. Basically, this is a simple case. It involves standard Texas law on insurance policy construction. The language, the focus of this matter is on the business pursuits clause, because State Farm refused to provide coverage to the Reeds for one reason. They said, aha, the business pursuits clause, hence the focus on the business pursuits clause. Now, this business pursuits clause, as it should be obvious to the members of the court, is really confusing. State Farm's own authorities, they've mentioned the Maryland Law Review article today. That article says, and I'm quoting here, "One need only read the business pursuits exclusion and its ordinarily incidental exception to understand why the courts routinely criticize its drafting and interpret it in at least three different ways. That's what their authority says. Their own authority, the Maryland Law Review article, also says the clause is, and I'm quoting here, so unclear on its face. So when we're looking at this clause, we start out with a preposition that the courts really have not consistently determined what it means. Not even the courts know what it means. Obviously, insurance company professionals and experts know what it means. Now, State Farm's lawyers here today say, yeah, we know what it means, but State Farm's own employees, State Farm's own insurance experts and employees really didn't know what it means. They wrote a rather lengthy and very candid reservation of rights letter, and they themselves say, well, gee, we have a question about whether this clause applies to the facts. They say, we're really uncertain here about whether you're going to have coverage because of this business pursuits clause. So although the lawyers may tell this court, yeah, it's clear as a bell and we know exactly what it means, State Farm at its heart and its employees did not.
Can you sort of clarify some procedural matters for me?
Yes, sir.
You claim in the trial court that the insurance policy was ambiguous?
Yes, sir.
You moved for summary judgment, I guess, on the basis that the ambiguity should be construed in your client's favor?
Yes, sir.
Can you explain in that context the point Ms. Beard raised about your request for a remand and what purpose that would serve if, in fact, mm-hmm. it should be decided as a matter of law as you urge in your motion for summary judgment?
Yes, sir. As a matter of clarification, Reed's moved for summary judgment in the trial court on four grounds. The trial court granted summary judgment on those four grounds. The Court of Appeals wrote on one of the four grounds. The one of the four grounds, as you pointed out, Judge Cornyn, one of the four grounds was ambiguity. Another one was that the exception to the business pursuits clause controlled the case. Another one was that the business pursuits clause, since it deals on its face with activities, was inapplicable to premises defects. And then the last one was that the clause was inapplicable to Mr. Reed, who had no business pursuits involved at all. Trial court, as I say, granted summary judgment on all those grounds. State Farm has agreed in their application for writ at page 17 and 18. They say, yeah, granted, adopted all of plaintiff's theories. And the Court of Appeals wrote on one. Now, why, having moved for summary judgment, did we say, well, in the alternative, remand, okay? I guess at its heart, that's a fail-safe device. Because since procedurally both sides moved for summary judgment, the court could, finding A, that summary judgment for Reed was improper, and B, denial of summary judgment for State Farm was improper, could then proceed to render the judgment that it felt was proper. In order to deal with that, in an alternative pleading, which is allowable under the rules, the Reed said, well, if you find that all of this stuff some way, somehow was wrong, then we would ask, instead of a reverse and render decision, we would ask for a reverse and remand decision. So it was an alternative pleading. How would that work here? Okay. Well, I remind the court that the trial court granted summary judgment on four grounds. The Court of Appeals wrote just on one. So if there is a determination by this court that there was some error in what the Court of Appeals wrote, some reversible error in what the Court of Appeals wrote, then as opposed to rendition of judgment, the court could remand to the Court of Appeals to consider the other grounds. Additionally, there is some case law, as State Farm points out in their one of their numerous briefs in the Court of Appeals. I know the court is I lost track at about 175 pages worth of State Farm briefing. State Farm pointed out below that some courts have stated that if there is an ambiguity, then that presents a jury issue to determine what that ambiguity is, to determine the true intent of the parties. So it was an alternative pleading only, and sort of a, what I'll say is a fail-safe device.
Do you have any thoughts on how we reconcile those cases that say an ambiguity presents a jury question as opposed to the canon of construction that you interpret ambiguities in insurance policies against the scrivener?
I think there's basically just two lines of thought on that.
They can't be reconciled?
I haven't reconciled them in my mind. Judge Gonzalez stated the general rule in the Hudson case, Judge Doggett wrote about it again in the Forbauer case, recently decided by this court. I think that's the general rule, but I haven't reconciled it in my mind. But there is a line of authority out there that talks about ambiguity equals a jury question.
With regard to ambiguity, what accounts for the declaration of the policy that no business pursuits are conducted at the premises?
What accounts for that, Your Honor?
Yes, sir.
Here's how I think that we deal with that. I think that may raise a potential defense for State Farm in later litigation, that there may have been an intentional misrepresentation.
What else could account for it? You just don't understand what business pursuits mean?
Well, I think that's true, too. Business pursuits has not been judicially defined until USAA versus Pennington in 1991. First time in Texas. Business pursuits is not defined in the policy either.
Why have the plaintiffs conceded that this activity on the property was a business pursuit?
Well, I'm not sure that plaintiffs have conceded that. When we argued that, and based on Ms. Burns' comments, when we argued that in the Court of Appeals, USAA versus to come out, there was some discussion about that. What I think, and I was asked a question by one of the Court of Appeals judges, was this a business pursuit? And I have to be candid, and I was candid with the Court of Appeals, and I'll be candid with you. Based on the 1991 decision, USAA versus Pennington, it seemed to me that Mrs. Reed was conducting a business pursuit. I mean, there are two legs here. One is continuity of activity, separate and apart from premises defect, I might add, but continuity of activity, number one, and number two, with a profit motive. And I think the evidence establishes that Mrs. Reed was conducting daycare activities on the premises, and she did charge some of the people for those services, although she did not charge all of them. And she took care of her grandchildren and other individuals in the home without pay.
But so, she charged the plaintiffs in this?
Yes, sir, she did.
And hence, Mr. Reed shared no profits, I think.
I'm not so sure about that. There's no summary judgment evidence to that effect.
Well, he had a legal right to share.
You mean the community property aspect,
yes,
of it? You and I are both speculating. My gut feeling would be probably yes, but there's no summary judgment proof on that one way or the other.
Well,
I don't know about that.
Doesn't the judgment in the underlying case settle the issue of whether this child was a business invitee because of the recitation of negligence? If the child was a licensee rather than an invitee, then there'd be a different standard of care owed by the Reeds toward the child, wouldn't it?
I don't have a problem with that either. I think.
So doesn't that settle whether Mr. Reed was engaged in this business?
No, sir. That's not settled.
What
is settled is that this child was on the premises, as Judge Hightower pointed out, was on the premises, and Mrs. Reed got paid for daycare services insofar as that child was concerned. And that to me says...
That is the business, is it not?
Yes, sir. Mrs. Reed's business.
What difference does it make whether Mr. Reed was involved?
Well, it makes a lot of difference because State Farm has said we ain't paying based on the business pursuits clause. All right, let me put this in perspective real briefly. The underlying case was the Fords suing Mr. and Mrs. Reed. Why did they sue Mr. Reed? Because Mr. Reed was an insured under the policy. Okay? State Farm then says, we're not going to pay that damage award because of the business pursuits clause. Okay? The business pursuits clause...
So you're saying Mrs. Reed was not insured under the policy?
No, sir. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that your question was, Mr. Reed, the reason that it's important business pursuits vis-a-vis Mr. Reed is that State Farm's only ground to refuse to pay is the business pursuits clause. If an insured, which Mr. Reed certainly was, is not, if Mr. Reed, who was an insured, has no business pursuits involved, then the business pursuits clause does not apply to him at all and does not exclude coverage for him. I think the evidence is clear. In fact, most of it comes from State Farm, that only Mrs. Reed had any business pursuits involved, and we've set it out in our brief in some detail.
If Mr. Reed had a community property interest in that business, does that involve him in the business too?
Again, we're speculating. I think the answer would be probable, but I don't know. That issue was not before the trial court or the Court of Appeals. And there's no summary judgment proof on it one way or another, so I don't think that can be a consideration.
That's one of the three,
sir.
That's one of the three areas that the court you submitted to the Court of Appeals, they never ruled on, and you're asking us if we disagreed with them on the one they did rule on, that the case be remanded to them to consider the three they didn't.
Yes, sir.
Now, as to the one they did rule on, what is the nature of the ambiguity in this policy?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity. As the court knows, ambiguity comes when there is more than one reasonable interpretation or construction of language. Which and there's another type of ambiguity.
In conjunction with Justice Doggett's question, I'm getting kind of frustrated here. I think things are getting a little over complex. It really looks pretty simple to me. Except activities therein which are ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits. What does the exception mean? What we're talking about is the exclusion. We're focusing on the exclusion. Whether this is a business. Well, assume it's a business. Assume that they're both involved in it. Assume there is a business exclusion. What does the exception mean? Is it meaningless? Is it excess verbiage? Is it, except activities therein which are ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits. What activities are incidental?
Okay.
A lot of homes have swimming pools. A lot of homes have swimming pools with fences around. A lot of homes have children with swimming pools with fences.
Yes, sir.
Those are not uniquely business pursuits. They had nothing to do with this business except you have a fence there to protect the kids? Yes, sir. Okay. I guess that brings up the premise defect argument. But
yes,
the point
sir.
Is... Are these uniquely business pursuits, or are these incidental to people's homes generally? Are they incidental to non-business pursuits, raising a family in a house with a pool?
I think you've honed in on one of the issues that I think is real critical here. The exception, and I'll use the court has it in front of it, but it says coverage shall not apply to any business pursuits of an insured. And, of course, we've said since Mr. Reed had no business pursuits, this doesn't apply to him. But it goes on to any business pursuits of an insured except activities therein. Except activities involved in the business pursuit, which are ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits. Okay? So, where do we go on that? What this means, according to State Farm's authorities, is that a certain class of activities are covered, of business activities are covered by this policy. And what are those? Those business activities which are ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits. All right? Where do we go on that? We look immediately to what kind of activities were involved. All right? Mrs. Reed, should she have been there supervising the child? Yeah. Of course. Well, what was she doing? She was out running household errands. Question. Is running household errands ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits? Yes. I would assume that the court would fire a clerk who spent work day out running household errands for their own household. It's really obvious. It's very simple. What was Mr. Reed doing? We haven't admitted anything as far as Mr. Reed is concerned. But we included him since he was involved. What was Mr. Reed doing? Mr. Reed was taking a nap on the couch. Is taking a nap on the couch ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits? Absolutely. You don't get paid for sleeping on the job.
Hell, but didn't Mrs. Reed leave him sort of in charge when she went out to do her household errands?
No, sir, I don't think she did. I think
Who was in charge when she left?
There was another lady there that worked with her. And the summary judgment record is silent as to what she was doing. She was working in the house. I think I'm having to pull out of my mind here, and I'll get the court some specifics out of the record.
The person that was there, she was hired by Mrs. Reed.
I'll have to say I'm unsure about that, but Mrs. Reed did not leave Mr. Reed in charge.
But it's reasonable to assume that she was there in an employee capacity to look after the children while Mrs. Reed was out running household errands?
I will assume that with the court, but I'm not sure about whether it's accurate or not. What she was doing is that she was, as I'm recalling now, she was inside making lunch for the kids.
Which is an ordinary responsibility for someone that's running a daycare facility.
Yes, it's also ordinarily responsibility for somebody who's involved in any kind of child care in the home, whether it's a business or not. A lot of the case law deals with people who are, the Tilly case, for example, the Crane case, for example, deal with people who were fixing lunch for children when an accident occurred and a child got hurt.
Tell me what sort of activity you think clearly would fall under that exception. What sort of activity in connection with the operation of a daycare center in a home would clearly fall under this policy exception?
Let me ask a question. In other words, you're asking me what kind of activity would be covered by the exception to the clause?
Yes.
The activities involved here.
No. The exclusion of coverage. What sort of activity would clearly be covered by the exclusion?
By the business pursuits exclusion?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So we're ignoring the exception. Okay.
Assuming the exception is there. With the exclusion and the exception, what sort of activity in connection with a daycare business in a residence would not be covered?
I have to think about that for a moment, but I think the answer to the question is we cannot look at the exclusion without looking at the exception to the exclusion, because we have to read it together. We can't ignore the exclusion, we can't ignore the exception. So the answer to the question would be, it would be an activity that was a business pursuit that was not or narrowly incidental to a non-business pursuit.
And what would that be?
I can't think of an example at this point.
I can't think of one either.
I think it would have to be, and I think the language and the case law and the authorities clearly envision that the exception means that a certain class of business activities are covered, and it defines those as ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits.
The rule of construction that if they're going to exclude something, they need to be specific.
Well, I think, Judge,
here you have, according to Judge Heck's perception here, an exclusion that, or an exception that encompasses the exclusion in daycare operations.
Well, I think that's right. And that, Judge Gonzalez, again, I hearken back to the Hudson case and also the Forbauer case, specifically and quite clearly says that, and I'll paraphrase here, that if you want to exclude something, you better make it clear, make it plain, make it unambiguous, and set it out in the black letter law of that exclusion. Otherwise, it ain't there. And I think the, as is obvious, premises defects is not there. Counsel tries to slide in that they're really one and the same, but in the Ketch case, Ketch versus Kroger case, recently out of this court noted that, hey, premises conditions and defects are absolutely different from negligent activities. So there is a difference there. Also, not specifically included in that language, besides its failure to address premises defects, I think your comment, Judge Gammage, is entirely appropriate, and that is we have to look at the exception and the exclusion and read them both together. And if it is unclear, if the language itself is unclear, there's ambiguity, and we all know what that means. One other thing, responses to your question, not only if the language is unclear, but even if the language is definite, but the scope and meaning of the language is unclear, there's an ambiguity. This court said so in the Barnett case.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
Counsel, let me ask you if I might to focus in on this last exchange between counsel and Justice Heck. If, as that seemed to suggest, the exception swallows the exclusion, then doesn't State Farm lose?
No, Your Honor. State Farm doesn't lose. But the problem with the respondent's construction of this policy is that it obviates the business pursuits exclusion entirely, because under the under a hypothetical that I offered to the Court of Appeals and I offered to this court, if you have a CPA who runs a business in his home, it's clearly a business, that's not a question. He's interviewing clients. It's a very busy time of year, precisely this time of year with April 15th coming up. The people that have come to his home share the entrance to his home with the entrance that his family uses. Those stairs are ordinarily incident to the non-business pursuit of having stairs on your home, which would be the construction that the respondents would offer. Another hypothetical, suppose someone has a business in his home in which he is entrusted with certain sensitive information for his clients, a condition very similar to the condition for Mrs. Reed's business, that she have a fence separating that dangerous area of water from her daycare play yard. As a condition of having these sensitive files, this client of a computer consultant requires that this person have an alarm system in his home. Your point, Justice Gammage, lots of homes have alarm systems. So we can say under the respondent's construction of this policy, as long as you can show that what something, anything related to liability was an incident to home ownership, you are never going to have a triggering of the business pursuits exception. And that is wrong.
Isn't that
because
what you have here? Isn't that what you have here?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that what you have here?
Under the construction of the Court of Appeals, that is what we do have, but that is what we would like to correct. Just
well, what activity do you believe comes under the exception to the exclusion?
Well, comes under that was that's I would like to respond to your question and to Justice Heck's question at the same time. I can think of a very good example. I think it's a good example. Suppose Mrs. Reed had her, and it's related to the facts of this case. Let's suppose that instead of having one of her business clients on her premises that day, suppose someone just called her and asked her if she could accommodate her for that day as a favor. And let's suppose she's under her limit for her maximum amount of children she can have that day. There is no business. There is no business. Yes, the injury, if that child drowned, arose in the business, but it's ordinarily incidental to doing someone a favor, in spite of the fact that it arose within the context
of... Excuse me, you're saying that if it had been one of her grandchildren who had drowned, it would be covered by the policy, but the fact that this was a client...
Exactly.
Client's child that drowned, not covered by the policy. Now, how does that meet the language of the exception, which says even business practices, the way I read it, even business pursuits are covered if it involves activity which are ordinarily incidental to non-business pursuits?
That's right, Your Honor, and that's the, I see the point. But that is exactly the
this is activity that would be ordinarily involved with her own grandchild, which does, who doesn't pay anything.
Right.
The fact that it's involved with a child of a paying customer brings it under the exclusion, but not the exception, even in face of the plain language of the exception. If that's not ambiguous, nothing is.
But it has
And
to be
how
reached.
Should the ambiguity be construed?
It should be construed against the insurer. You're absolutely right. But there has
insurer,
to be...
Insurer, not insured.
Insurer, excuse me. Beg your pardon. Again, this is the reason why we stress the important relationship between the insuring agreement, the notation, this is the homeowner's policy, there's a declaration of no business pursuit, there's the insuring agreement which says, you have to be legally obligated to pay. How are you legally obligated to pay? The underlying judgment. And as far as the respondents coming here and saying, this is the posture of this case, the respondents appeared before the court and said, this is our judgment. Indemnify us. Indemnify us. This was a bench trial to the court. Both people were before that court, a bench trial. Court knows implies all fact findings. So all of these questions relating to basically judgment calls on the evidence in the underlying case, we can change. They can't change it. It was allowed to become final and it's not appealed. The Court of Appeals couldn't change it. This court can't change it. Now we suggested a way of cutting through the poles. One view eats up the exception. One view eats up the exclusion. The better reasoned cases, Kelsey, even Moore case, even the Rodriguez case, note that there has to be a causal link. That's what creates the legal obligation to pay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience is advised.